Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Marcus Coomer, Senior Vice President, the Internet Society. And Marcus is a world-renowned, top-ranking Internet governments and policy authority. So, Marcus, just an amazing, remarkable background. You've had so many outstanding contributions, having significant global impact. So thank you for coming in today and sharing so much of your expertise and insights and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the introduction. I'm not sure how to react. Somehow it seems to be exaggerating and flattering my ego, slightly overstating the case. What I tried to be was to be a facilitator, to bring people together, make them talk and listen to each other, and if I have succeeded in that endeavor, then I'm very pleased indeed. And it's a pleasure talking to you.
Well, again, thank you for coming in, Marcus. You'll bring so many insights to our audience. And I should mention our audience has a high amount of executives and ICT, so they will view your answers through this lens and in terms of what's the value to them and why they should care, so in the questions that follow. Now, you have your role with the Internet Society and it's completing. Can you talk more about that and what led to your last role and what you wish to do next?
Well, it came quite naturally. Followed my UN role where I had been involved in precisely bringing people together, make them talk to each other, and by doing that, I learned a lot about the Internet and the Internet community, and joining ISOC was a natural step after that. In ISOC, I've been involved in public policy, Internet governance discussion. I certainly very much subscribe to the Internet model as I came to understand it, which is very distributed, bottom-up, private sector-led, and this is very best suited to the underlying technology, which is also a distributed technology. And when talking, obviously, to business executives, it might be helpful to remind them that not everybody sees it that way. There are others who would like to have a more government-led model, and I think for business, the former is certainly more conducive to business success than the latter. A government-led model, I think, would stifle the technological development and would also stifle business opportunities. And I think that's why it is important that business executives get involved in these discussions, but that they also listen to concerns that governments may have, and they try also to address their concerns.
Now, could you talk more then about the Internet Society, their past and then future importance to business first and then governments and academia?
Well, the Internet Society was set up by some of the Internet pioneers, in particular by the two inventors of the underlying Internet protocol, the TCP/IP, Winsurf and Bob Kahn, back in 92, so fairly early years before the Internet really took off in the 90s. And the Internet Society has always been there to promote the Internet, to bring it to the people. The Internet is for everyone, is the motto. And the strength, I would say, of the Internet Society is it operates at the intersection of public policy, of technology, and also of development. So whatever policy recommendations we may issue, they're based on a very solid technological understanding of the Internet, and at the same time they have benefited from the reality check of development work on the ground. The Internet Society has been very active in developing countries in particular, in bringing the Internet to the people, setting up Internet exchange points, and that shows then also what the best practices are for doing that, what policies work and what policies don't work. And that, I think, remains as relevant as it was to the beginning. It also shows the high respect the Internet Society enjoys, I think, among all stakeholder groups. Many governments turn to us asking for advice when it comes to technological details, and at the same time we are engaged with civil society talking on society's issues relating to the Internet's impact on society. Business we are also very close to. We have organizational members, we have an advisory council where major Internet companies and other businesses that deal with the Internet are represented. So I think the Internet Society remains a reference for all stakeholder groups, and I'm perfectly confident that we'll continue to be that.
Now, you were asked by the United Nations to chair the preparatory process for the annual meeting in the Internet's Governance Forum. What did you hope to accomplish, and what were the challenges, and then what were the main issues in Internet governance, and how will they be resolved?
So that was actually last year. That was in 2013. I was asked to chair the preparatory process for the meeting that took place in Bali. Last year was a very challenging year as it coincided with the disclosures about mass surveillance, and that really had caused a seismic shift in the discussions on Internet governance. And it was a challenge to react to these disclosures, but the Internet Governance Forum stood up to the challenge and faced the discussion. And it was also interesting to see that the U.S. government took up the challenge and came to the Internet Governance Forum meeting in Bali to face the community. And that really was important for the Internet Governance Forum to prove its relevance. Had it not addressed the issue, I think it would have lost its relevance. But it was possible to have a healthy and robust discussion on these issues, and by doing so, I think the Internet Governance Forum proved its value to the community as a platform where you can discuss important issues, controversial issues, in a civilized manner where people actually don't just talk but also listen to each other. Now the question, what are the 3 to 5 main issues? They always shift, and you could almost say they range from the sublime to the ridiculous. Surveillance, yes, in many ways everybody knew it was happening. There have always been spies, and I think there always will be spies. But most people were surprised at the very scale. And we will not resolve that issue, but I think it is important to continue to have discussions on it and also to be transparent as much as possible so that we know who does what and when and how, and that we develop over the years also some principles. There are other issues such as spam. Most people had thought it wasn't an issue anymore, but it came up at the World Conference on International Telecommunications in Dubai at the end of 2012, when many developing countries identified spam as a major issue. Now, there's no solution that is 100% safe with regard to spam, but we know how to mitigate the problem. In this particular case, not everybody knows about it. So what needs to be done is to make the solutions, how to mitigate the problem, more widely known. And we will pick this up at this year's Internet Governance Forum in Istanbul and have a best practices session. And then we hope to provide a toolkit to participants they can take home and so they know how to deal with it. There are other issues, such as child pornography, cybercrime in its broadest form. All these are complex issues, and there is no easy solution for any of them. They are all complicated. There are various questions coming in. There may be, when you try to solve a problem, then you may have an impact on freedom of speech. Now, in my experience, it is important that you narrow down the problem, that you share what are the practices, the best practices that help dealing with the problem, coping with the problem, maybe not resolving it, but mitigating the problem. Look at what works well, what works less well, and above all, not go for the wrong solution. There is an old saying, first do no harm, and I think keeping that in mind is still relevant. There was a case 2 years back when they had some rioting in the UK. Then there were some ministers who proposed, okay, let's shut down social networks. But then other ministers said, no, no, that would be a wrong solution that cannot be seen as a solution in a democratic state, which is upholding freedom of speech, freedom of expression. So to cut the long story short, there are many problems, and maybe the main problem is that we have here a global network, a technology without borders, and our global system is based on national borders, and it is difficult to cooperate across the borders, and it clashes with the notion of national sovereignty. But moving ahead, we have to find a way of sharing sovereignty and finding cooperation across the borders to deal with these problems. And much progress has been made. I mean, law enforcement, they do cooperate across the borders. But again, if in the offline world crime is committed in New York or Geneva, you know that the person who committed the crime was also in New York or in Geneva. With the online world, a crime can be committed in New York and the perpetrator can have been in a completely different place. It can have been in Geneva and vice versa. So that obviously it's very basic, I know, but it adds challenges. And we are still coping with a technology which is, after all, still a very young technology. Experts who are more expert than I have compared it to the life of an adult. And they say the internet, well, it's maybe not a child anymore, but it's a young adolescent and still growing up, and it's still developing and evolving, and what is important is that we don't stifle its growth and development, and we have to accept that there are growth problems. Like with any teenager, every parent knows that these can be difficult years, but in the end, the teenager will be a grown-up man or woman and will assume also more responsibility. And if you allow this image for the internet, we have to live through growing pains as the internet is growing up, but let's not stifle the growth.
This question is somewhat related, and perhaps there'll be some overlap between the previous question and this one, but what do you see as the three main internet controversies today, and then their impact on business?
Well, one of the major controversy has always been the role of the government that actually invented or facilitated the invention of the internet and its continued role in the running of the internet, that is the United States. And because it is the United States as the one preponderant superpower, it made this discussion very political, and this continues, and although there is no connection to the mass surveillance disclosures of last year that many governments other than the United States made this shortcut, and it sort of undermined the trust also in the role of the United States. Now, this discussion is an ongoing discussion which has a long tradition, and at the same time, I would like to emphasize that the United States has used its stewardship role in a very responsible manner and has never actually politicized the Internet. But the paradox was that it was the United States that had this particular role that made it very political. Now we're in a phase where the U.S. government has announced it's ready to transfer its stewardship over the IANA function to the international community. And we are in the phase of finding a way how best to replace the role of the U.S. government. And this remains very much in the forefront of the discussions. And what is the impact on business? Obviously, business wants a reliable internet, an internet that is secure, resilient, and stable. And any solution that would endanger the main qualities of the internet would obviously have a negative impact on business. So, but business is engaged in these discussions. And then there is all over the world this discussion on net neutrality, which is in many ways a confused discussion. There are many definitions of what net neutrality is or is not, but there is no agreement on any definition beyond a given group. But it is obvious a discussion that is of importance to business, how the network is managed in an appropriate way. Many say it's a false discussion, but the open internet is at the heart of this discussion, and the open internet is something we want to maintain also for the future. But what is important is that there is a well-functioning competition, that we have transparency in the markets, and that the internet remains open, and let's not go down the wrong direction with over-managing the internet with good intentions. May be good, but as the saying goes, the path to hell is paved with good intentions. So we have to be careful there that well-meant legislation doesn't have a negative impact on the internet and on business. Otherwise, as I said, there are many issues almost ranging from the sublime to the ridiculous. But what is important, I think, is that we build and rebuild trust in the internet as a technology people can use without having to be afraid.
Now, you were also involved in the WSIS process from the first phase, and if you can probably, you know, give sort of a quick overview of what WSIS is. And then what outcomes are important to business, and how can ICT executives influence future outcomes?
Well, the World Summit on the Information Society was essentially called for to bridge the digital divide, to help developing countries catch up. But the internet governance came very much into the forefront of WSIS 1, which was held in 2003 in Geneva, and then 2005 in Tunis. I was involved first with the Swiss government, and then I was asked by the UN to be the secretary to the Working Group on Internet Governance, which came up with a working definition on Internet governance and a report that was by and large endorsed by the second phase of the summit in Tunis in 2005. And the outcome, I would say, was important to business because it recognizes that the existing internet governance arrangements worked well and are effective, and it recognized the need for internet governance arrangements to include non-governmental actors, private sector, civil society, but also the technical community. And the governments, in short, could not do it alone. It recognized that it's a fast-moving technology that needs the involvement of all stakeholders. Business was very involved in the negotiations, and in the process, especially WGIG opened the process and made it much more inclusive, and then the second phase was certainly more inclusive than the first phase. And for a UN summit in particular, where normally it's government-led, which is okay, it's a summit of heads of state and government, but business was much more integrated in the second phase, and they greatly contributed to the positive outcome. And it remains important that executives remain involved to defend the open technology, which, and also the private sector leadership in driving the technology and developing the future of the technology.
So we're going to do a shift now in terms of the questions and maybe broaden the topic somewhat, and also delve into your background and some of the lessons you've learned. So can you describe your most significant and influential achievements and then the practical outcomes seen today and forecasted into the future?
Well, that's a difficult question, but I think, as I said at the outset, I see myself and have seen myself mainly as a facilitator, and I think the working group on internet governance was maybe my most significant achievement at a time where there was a very confused discussion on what internet governance is and a very polarized discussion, as the head of the secretariat supporting this group. I think I contributed to a process where people from really different political and social, cultural backgrounds learned to talk and listen to each other and respect each other. I wouldn't say they all became friends in the process, but they certainly came to respect each other, and some of the members have already approached me, said we should have a kind of class reunion next year to celebrate the 10th year anniversary of the report of this working group, which became known under the name of WGIG. And this is actually something I might look forward to doing after now I leave ISOC, actually to sit down and just write down my experience in running this process, which was a fascinating process and also influential in so far as it shaped the outcome of a world summit, as I said, with his two in Tunis, by and large endorsed the outcome of the WGIG report.
Now, what's clear from, you know, your work and the prior question is that there's leadership involved. So you have an extensive leadership history, and it's well known and respected, and in fact legendary among some circles. So what leadership lessons do you wish to share to help executives in their roles?
Well, I'm not sure whether I can give lessons to any executive, but I think also there are various types of leadership, and they depend to a large degree also on the personality. And there is some leadership standing up front and telling the troops to follow, which is not my style of leadership. My style is more leading from behind, listening to what people have to say, and finding compromise. When you listen to different people, you can sense that the solution maybe not on the left nor on the right, but somewhere in the middle between them. And this is also very much based on my own personal background as a citizen of a country, Switzerland, which is based on strong culture of compromise, and also a strong culture of rejecting what Swiss would call a strong leader, which is more a really bottom-up democracy, which mistrusts strong leaders. And the Swiss system is built so that there are many inbuilt checks and balances which make it impossible for a strong leader actually to emerge and to take control, but it is also very distributed. So my own cultural background coming from that country, I think, makes me very receptive for the internet culture of having distributed bottom-up democratic processes. And I think the most important lesson maybe is listening to people, what they have to say, what their concerns are, and taking people seriously. But again, I would not be pretentious in saying this is I have leadership lessons to give to executives who have learned in their own way on how to perform their functions.
I guess with so much diversity out there, though, you know, you're sort of this idea of being collaborative and then listening to others and respecting their position and so on. I mean, really that defines leadership going forward. I mean, especially in today's world and especially with the internet connecting all things. So I think your work is a model for ICT leaders out there to look at what you've done and what you've achieved and emulate some of the things and that allowed you to have a lot of success. Now, you've been in the field for some time in a variety of different positions. Can you name some people who inspire you, and why is this so?
Well, past, present, and future, yes. I mean, today is Mandela's birthday, and obviously he is he was an outstanding leader of the past century, and in a previous function working for the Swiss government, I actually had the fortune of meeting him personally. It was a mundane event. I had to organize a lunch for heads of state. Our Swiss federal president invited heads of state and government who came to Geneva to the 50th anniversary of the GATT, the WTO meeting in 98. And Nelson Mandela was among them, and his presence in the room was just towering, his charisma. I had to guide him to the table. "Mr. President, would you like to follow me to your table?" And he asked, "Can I hold your arm?" To do so, I mean, his humility, it's just awesome. I think he was really filling the room with his charisma. And I think, well, everything has been said about him. There's not much to add, but he is definitely, the most inspiring personality one can think of. Another personality who inspired me very much was the man who was Under Secretary General of the United Nations during, with his time, Nitin Desai, an Indian national who was then the chairman of the Working Group on Internet Governance and then also a special advisor to the Secretary General on Internet Governance. And he in many ways was my mentor. He is a very calm, very wise man. He's very good at listening again and, but guiding discussions in a calm manner and, after listening to all the interventions, again, finding a way forward where everybody feels comfortable. And he really is also very inspiring man. And maybe closer to the Internet Society, I was also very impressed by the former CEO, Lynn Sintermore, who recruited me for the Internet Society, and her energy, everlasting energy, and also her enthusiasm and belief in the Internet. I mean, she was there throughout the World Summit and always spoke out on behalf of the Internet community, very tireless and very passionate. She's also a truly inspiring personality.
Marcus, you have this remarkable ability to work amongst the significant people from around the world in different domains and so on, and also to experience much in your travels and in your work and in your past work as well. So I was thinking maybe a lot of things don't surprise you because you've seen them before, but do things surprise you? Is there something that comes across and you go, wow, that's quite unexpected. That I'm surprised by that.
A good question. I mean, a lot of what you hear in the discussions is not new, but is a repetition of what you heard before. Sometimes you may be surprised that you feel that people don't listen or don't understand, or you think that really should be well known by now by everyone. There were some comments made at the conference in Dubai where governments said, yes, but I want to know the internet traffic that goes through my country. And you tell them, yes, but the internet isn't built that way. And then they, yes, but I want to know. In a way, trying to ignore how the technology works, but still insisting. That may be a surprise. But sometimes you're also surprised in a nice way by just hearing nice stories. I do remember I was just very anecdotal. I was attending a conference in Morocco of the African Regional Internet Registry, and then there was a guy in the lift with me and said, oh, I was at the Internet Governance Forum meeting in Rio. And I said, oh, did you enjoy it? He said, no, I was disappointed. And then I was disappointed. He said, why were you disappointed? He said, oh, I went back with full of good ideas, and then my superiors did not allow me to implement these good ideas I had learned from the meeting. Now, on the one hand, this is a disappointing story, but on the other hand, I was surprised in a positive way by this guy's right approach to the meeting. He took that as a meeting where he goes to learn from others, and that was exactly how he had conceived the meeting. So that is an unexpected positive surprise to hear that from someone, that he actually got it and got what you intended to do, with an unhappy outcome because his superiors stopped him from doing what he wanted to do. But nevertheless, a surprise, a positive one.
Well, that's an interesting and quite satisfying sort of anecdote in terms of your surprises. So now you've got this amazing background in policy. And so do you see or recommend any policy improvements that should be made, let's say, in the next 2 years? And how this could be sort of, you know, worked out internationally?
Well, there's definitely, we do have a deadline. I did mention the announcement of the U.S. government to hand over its stewardship over the ANA function, which is, in a way, the heart of the Internet to the international community. And they gave a deadline till September 2015. And that is now what has to happen. And the community has taken up the challenge and started the discussion. And I think if we set a solid international framework responding the guidelines the U.S. government gave, that is that no, it should be handed over to the international community, it should not affect the openness, the stability, and the security of the Internet, and that governments should not be in charge of the exercising the stewardship function. And if this is done in a responsible way, then I think it will greatly enhance the acceptance and reduce also some of the political tensions that have been around discussions on internet governance, because they are mainly related to the role, the stewardship role of the United States. So this is clearly top priority. And then what other improvements? Yes, there are issues that need to be maybe not resolved, but brought closer to closure. And there's definitely always room for improvement in improving cooperation across borders. Also, as I said, in some cases solutions are known, but not by everyone. So to make, improve the general understanding of where solutions can be found, the Internet Governance Forum can play an important role in doing that as a place where people can go to and to enhance this function as a one-stop go-to place where people can get the information needed to find solutions to their problem.
So we're going to even broaden sort of the question here, and that I guess I'm going to get into this idea of computing. Computing is pervasive. It's embedded into everything in some fashion, or I guess the technology aspects of computing in many ways. But as I mentioned, it advises everything in our lives today, and is part of business and industry, governments, academia, media, society. It's just so pervasive. So there's this idea about computing being a recognized profession on par with accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, this idea of quality assurance and recognized credentials. What are your feelings about that?
I have somewhat mixed feelings. I mean, I do see the positive aspects of that, and to have a sort of code of ethics is definitely a positive approach, but at the same time, all these recognized professions have a long tradition in some cases, more than 1,000-year-old tradition, thinking of the medical profession. And at the same time, it can lead to a tendency of having a closed profession, whereas computing, the internet, has traditionally been very open. And from the technical community, we are so very wedded to the axiom that there is permissionless innovation, that any kid can, in his or her garage, invent something new and make it happen. We would not have had voice over IP or social media without that approach. And by making it too, I'm not saying that it's putting a straight jacket around it, but there is a kind of danger of making it less open and of making it more of a closed profession, which might then sort of exclude this aspect of permissionless innovation. Now, I don't know enough about it and the initiatives that have been going on. But as I said, I would hate to see that all of a sudden computing is seen like the bar or like the medical profession, where you have exams, and in some countries where then the profession says how many people are allowed in, that I would like to see it continue as a very open profession. But if there's a voluntary agreement on some basic ethical standards, definitely would be very supportive of that. And I do know there exist initiatives among computer professionals precisely to have this approach. But as I said, as long as it doesn't have a downside to it and locks out people from the profession.
Marcus, you've had this remarkable ability to travel and to engage with people all over the world from all different kinds of backgrounds, and really from industry and governments and academia, civil society, and so on. And you've been in the center of many discussions and perhaps even intense discussions. From all of your extensive speaking travels and work, do you have any one or more stories that you can share? You did share one earlier, but perhaps another one or two or three, maybe something amusing or surprising, unexpected, or amazing.
Okay, yeah, I remember an amusing one, and it was in the early days of internet governance discussion. There was a delegate who said, it's just not right that one country, the U.S., controls the administration of the DNA. Everybody looked around in surprise. What is she talking about? She was obviously talking about the DNS, the domain name system, that she confused it with the DNA. Now, having said that, you don't hear that kind of very basic mistake anymore. I mean, people now, on the whole, are much better informed than they were 10 or 12 years ago. So that amused me. Surprising, the IGF has sort of triggered off national and regional internet governance forums, and in many countries, this is, especially in developing countries, it's not necessarily in the tradition that governments actually consult professional bodies. Again, I come from a country, Switzerland, where we have direct democracy, and if the government wants anything to happen, they have to consult very upstream all the relevant professional organizations, farmers, unions, whatever. Otherwise, people collect signatures and they vote about it. So there is a very broad consultative process, but this is not the case in many countries. And one of the meetings I was in West Africa, there was a West African Internet Governance Forum, and there were government officials turning up, and one of the professionals, internet professionals, said, oh, this is the first time actually the government is talking to us. And while that was surprising, at the same time, it was also very satisfying to see that it actually, this process had triggered off, had a positive effect in so far as governments started talking to the people directly concerned. And on the same line, I do remember, I heard from a Kenyan friend, who told me that the, very senior person in the Kenyan ICT ministry actually engaged actively in LISP discussions. And I had lunch with him in Nairobi, and I said, I heard that you engage in LISP discussions with civil society, technical community. I find that amazing that someone of your seniority does it. His answer was, yes, it can be painful at times, but it helps us make better decisions. And I thought that was just so spot on and great to him. And Kenya, by the way, has now enshrined in their constitution an article that the government needs to consult when discussing new legislation. So this is, I think, for me, maybe the most positive and most telling experience in how important this dialogue between all the stakeholders is.
You know, I like that story because, you know, the internet is sort of grounded on being sort of grassroots and collaborative, and here it's informing governments as well and causing them to grow in terms of their insight. And that's a good story. You choose the topic area, and what do you see as any top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Well, when it comes to the internet, I think I mentioned what I see as the top challenge already. That is basically, how do you reconcile a borderless technology with a world that is based on national sovereignty and national borders? Again, there ain't no easy answer, but I think we have to move forward, changing our mindset, and we can learn actually from the European Union. They have developed their concept of shared sovereignty. That is, they pool some of the aspects of their national sovereignty into a common pool of sovereignty, like border control, where they have the Schengen treaties. And I think this is hopefully the way forward at the global level. But at the same time, obviously, I realize this is a long-term process. This is not easy, but that we actually start by considering the internet a shared global resource that we have to manage together as a pooled resource in a shared concept of sovereignty. And this needs obviously to evolve over the years. Outside the internet, there are also many challenges. We have the developmental challenges, but the internet can be part of the solutions. Climate change, while the internet contributes to climate change, it can also be part of the solution by helping to measure, and it is already part of the process of the solutions.
Well, we're down to our last question, and I'm sort of reversing the tables here, in that I'm asking you, if you were conducting this interview, what one or more questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
These are difficult questions, and yes, are you here referring to the sort of my area of speciality, or are you referring to the world outside the internet as well? Because yes, there is the internet, but there is a broader world, and we do have to face developmental issues, and sometimes when we're wrapped up in our internet or internet governance world, we tend to forget that there are other problems out there, and the internet can be part of the solution, but the I think all the problems are related to a world which is shrinking, and the system we have based on national sovereignty cannot cope with these issues unless we find global solutions. Europe is faced with a stream of migration coming from Africa across the Mediterranean. Yes, we can close our borders, but people come nevertheless. I think the US is faced with the same problem coming from Latin America. You can build big fences, but people come all the same. Now, how do you stop migration? By building fences or by helping countries and looking at the problem at the root? So they're all related to basically a globalized world without borders, where the system we have is not adequately equipped to tackle the problems. Now, the internet definitely is, if anything, as I see it, more part of the solution than part of the problem. It is the backbone of our globalized world. It connects people, it brings people together. I think the digital natives of today, they feel much more as world citizens than our generation of digital immigrants feel. I'm still more wedded to the nation state, and hopefully once the digital natives will take over, they will see the world more as one world where you have a concept of shared sovereignty, of finding global solution, not by building fences, but by making sure that there is an orderly migration. Migration was always part of mankind's history, but also that you look at the development of the people in their countries, tackle the problem at the root, and help them to find jobs there so that they don't feel the need to migrate. That will also reduce the pressure and the tensions in the countries which are the targets of these streams of migration. But this is not maybe a precise answer you have looked for. It's more rambling about which I see as one of the core problems also related to the internet, which I have alluded to before, how to reconcile a borderless technology with a world built on borders.
Additional questions you may want to ask if you were to reverse the tables and you were the interviewer, but you're interviewing yourself in essence. Do you have any more to add to that, and then what would be your answers?
Well, how would you solve the problem?
I see. That's a good one. And I guess it speaks to all of the things that you talked about, this sort of more collaborative process. And maybe there's a lot of things that we can learn from your country in the way that you've managed affairs over all these years. It's interesting that I chair something called the Global Industry Council, and one of our senior delegates or directors, who also was the founding chief scientist for one of the largest companies in the world. In fact, he founded all of their research lab. He indicated that his research is saying, geographic boundaries are going to disappear, in essence. Country boundaries, in essence, are going to disappear, driven by the internet. But he also said corporate boundaries are going to disappear as well. And that's going to totally change and create upheavals in society, because people no longer go to a particular company. Or for that matter, be identified even with a particular country. It'll just be sort of people meeting each other in virtual communities. Do you have any thoughts on that?
That's an interesting aspect. I have to admit I never thought about that, but the disappearance of boundaries and the, well, that's in a way which was maybe not thought through, but what I said, that the younger generation, the people who have grown up with the internet, they clearly function differently from the people who moved into the internet, but who grew up differently. I mean, the digital natives versus the digital immigrants. And I heard a friend in Hong Kong, he made the point that in the offline world, it is the natives who make the laws for the immigrants, and in the online world, it seems to be the immigrants make the laws for the natives. So we have to wait for the natives to make the laws for all the people. But once the natives move into the position of responsibility, that will invariably happen. And then I think picking up on what your scientist said, I think I can indeed visualize this coming, then, that we will live in a different world. And I find this aspect of the boundaries of corporations coming down as an interesting part of this equation.
Yes, or even all the research involving, there's the European Brain Project, and of course the U.S. also has one as well, and DARPA has recently funded a project in terms of restoring active memory, where they're interfacing hardware, in essence, with different parts of the brain, and where memories can actually be stored digitally. I mean, where is this all going to lead? Or deep learning, where increasingly they're building more and more complex systems that have the ability to, in essence, understand, like the never-ending language learner, which Tom Mitchell is building at Carnegie Mellon, which is learning to read the web. It's teaching itself, and perhaps in 10 years it'll have read everything, it consumed everything on the web, and in 10 years that'll be, let's say, perhaps over 20 to 25 zettabytes of data, which a zettabyte is 1 billion terabytes. I mean, where does this all lead to? And I think it's going to be an interesting world that we're getting into, and you being a big part of this, and all of it somewhat connected by the internet, this internet being the next sort of global internet-based nervous system for the world, and perhaps for all of community as well, or mankind, or humankind, I guess.
Well, definitely. The internet is a technology that has changed the world and continues doing so.
Well, Marcus, you've been at the heart of a lot of this, and I know your schedule is demanding, and we have indeed been fortunate to have you come in to do this interview. And thank you for sharing so much of your insights and wisdom with our audience.
Well, it has been a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Marcus Coomer, Senior Vice President of the Internet Society. And Marcus is a world-renowned, top-ranking Internet Governance and Policy Authority.